thank you very much for the invitation, and let me explain then what why you stare at all these logos and wonder whether next year I will have a Coke t-shirt or something. Or see two of our former distinguished students. So there's this new theory institute that's starting in Canada, like with a $100 million endowment. But I've learned that what we do, I mean, ITC is not considered theoretical physics, so I figured the only way to cash in would be to sort of change. I can look a little bit more like
that. That's not the word.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's a great. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So, there's no standard model in ITC, although perhaps a Hubbard model. So let me show you some of my collaborators. I'll be speaking mostly about the thesis work of, at least for the attractive Hubbard model, of Steve Allen, one of a pair of twin theoretical physicists, and Ben Sukyun, a postdoc, and Yuri Vilk, who really started this way of looking at the many-body problem a few years back. And over the years, a number of postdocs and students and undergraduate students even have been involved in this project. So, I will motivate the talk. I will be talking about the Hubbard model. From weak to intermediate coupling means from minus the bandwidth up to the bandwidth, where the bandwidth is 8T. So the first question is it relevant for ITC? I'm afraid that not only will I look as if I have deceived the high energy theorists who might be in the room, but even the ITC people, since we more or less all understand that the ITC are located at U about 1.5 the bandwidth, or in other words, in the strong coupling regime. Well, I will argue that it's a little bit a question of a threshold values, of critical values of coupling constants. For example, if I am at half filling, so delta equals zero, and U is increased, and in general there is some next nearest neighbor hopping, T prime, pretty soon you get into some ordered state, and then once you're in the ordered state, we don't believe there's another phase transition, so whether we came in this SDW state from a MUT insulator or from an itinerant magnet, once you're in the state, it's pretty much what it is. And then I will argue for continuity also, in the sense that if we find the pseudo gaps in intermediate coupling, and then there's no phase transition, as we crank up the coupling, there shouldn't be huge differences. Then I will also argue for the importance of quantitative predictions, and I will try to argue that it's possible to have quantitative predictions in this parameter domain. Like, for example, if there are quantum critical points here, where are they? Or if you want, for a given U, if there's one quantum critical point, where is it located? Or is the Hubbard model ferromagnetic? Also, effective models may be in weak coupling, I'm sorry. And suppose we find new quasi-particles in strong coupling, because after all, the idea of spin charge separation and all these things is to have quasi-particles that are weakly interacting. So if we find new particles that are weakly interacting, there will be residual interaction. So how do we treat this? One of the possible ways of treating this is to take the Landau approach and say, okay, well, there will be some effective Landau parameters, and we don't really know how to compute Landau parameters, so we give up and we work with some Landau parameters. But how do we predict when the Landau theory fails, when there are residual interactions? So we still need some macroscopic approach. And also, I will argue that this is a necessary endeavor, because standard methods give qualitatively incorrect results. So now that I have motivated the talk, let me, well, you're free to leave if you're really a strong coupling person and doesn't want to hear anything about intermediate coupling. So there will be basically three parts here. and a conclusion. So I will describe what the standard approach to this problem is and what the problems are with it, and I will describe our contribution, so another way of looking at non-perturbative approach, and I will mention some results. So in these three parts of the talk, I ask you to forget about ITC for a moment, in the sense that what the proof of the approach will be, and the approach that we will take is that we will do some analytical work and compare with Monte Carlo. So our experiment is Monte Carlo. If what I see does not agree with your favorite experiment, then perhaps it's because the material is not described by the Hubbard model in that parameter regime. And then in the conclusion, I'm going to make connections with ITC, and then it's going to be more speculative and become more lively, and everybody will start contradicting each other. So if that's what you're in for, then you have to wait for the conclusion. So is that a fair? Okay, way too.
We heard talks describing how sensitive the numerical experiments are to a large variety of tunings, like T primes and boundary conditions.
Right, that's right.
So how, I mean, do you have a particular set of robust numerical experiments in mind? Or?
Well, the only experiments I will look at is with the nearest neighbor hopping T. But we have also done Monte Carlo for T prime and looked at these approaches with T prime. And I won't show you plots, but it works also with T prime. So I know it's robust with T prime. I don't know how robust it is with near neighbor interactions. But I'm talking only about the local model. So what is the standard approach is to write out a free energy functional, or the Lejeune transform of a free energy functional, which you write out as a set of connected diagrams. And what you would do is to work with the renormalized propagators. So there's no self-energy insertions on these. I will tell you in a moment why you would do this. And then the recipe is to compute the self-energy from a functional derivative of this, and to compute the irreducible vertices from a functional derivative of that, so second derivative of this. Why is that a good way to do this, or why is it considered to be the most up-to-date way of doing calculations? Okay, what I'm going to say applies to self-consistent T-matrix approximation, fluctuation exchange approximations, a number of self-consistent perturbative schemes that are being used. Well, the big advantage is that it's thermodynamically consistent. In other words, if I take a derivative of F with respect to mu, I get the same as trace G. Satisfies Luttinger's theorem. In other words, the volume of the Fermi surface at t equals zero is guaranteed to be preserved if the series converges. It satisfies Ward identities, in other words, conservation laws, and that means that the four-point function such as this, when you apply the time derivative and the divergence of current, is appropriately related to the single particle quantity. So let me give you one qualitatively incorrect result. I believe that this state-of-the-art approach, I would say, gives. So if you look at the Hubbard model for repulsive case at relatively low temperature, but not so low, at half filling, here is a relatively small lattice, 8x8, and you look at the energy dispersion curves, in other words, A of K and omega. So for various values of K, I move in the Brillouin zone like this, and then this is plotted there for every one of these curves for a different wave vector. So what the quantum Monte Carlo is telling us is that if you get on the Fermi surface, then the peak should split here. Now if you do this any sort of self-consistent calculation, doesn't matter what subset of diagrams you sum actually, you get this. So there's no splitting like this.
Well, it was actually the status. I mean, I've heard many times the message that both the minus sign and the maximum entropy cause all kind of pitfalls in the Monte Carlo calculation. I mean, this is really to be trusted.
This is at half filling, so there's no minus sign problem. Yeah. And the maximum entropy I can tell you, I will show you comparisons with the analytic approaches. And in the analytic case, you can do the analytic continuation, you have the analytic result. And you can do the maximum entropy on your imaginary time data. So you can check how accurate. This is a small fraction of the bandwidth, you realize. There's a factor.
It's still large, I mean.
But it's still large, yes.
Was the flex calculation also done in imaginary time and then continued?
Absolutely.
Yes. By numerical methods?
By the same maximum entropy technique.
Okay.
What happens if you do it, I can tell you, is a comment for specialists, but if you do it for flex, it doesn't cause too many problems, but for other perturbative schemes, I will mention, if you do for small systems, you tend to get a series of spikes here instead of just a smooth function, right? But so if you do maximum entropy, then this is smoothed out. And then you can do a huge system because you do it analytically. If you do a huge system, then you get something which is smooth, and you can do both analytically and with maximum entropy and check that everything is consistent.
I mean, qualitatively, those two sets are not that different, except for that spreading.
That's right, but that's the pseudo gap, right?
Oh, okay.
So why do we expect this to be the good answer physically? At high temperature, let's see, not high on the scale of the mean field transition temperature, but low compared with the Fermi energy or U. If I look near the Fermi surface, if there were no interactions, I would just get E versus K, so a delta function along this line. But with interactions, there's some spreading of this spectral weight. Now, if you look at zero temperature, at half filling, we know there's a spin density wave or there's some form of long-range anti-ferromagnetic order. So there's a gap that opens up. If a gap opens up, then when I look at the probability of having an electron of momentum kF, then it can be there or there. So there's two peaks. Now, if you heat the system a little bit slowly, the question is how do you get from this to this? And the physically reasonable answer is through some intermediate step like that. So, okay, this standard approach that I mentioned looks nice, and there are many nice features, but what theoretically, you know, independently of the results, what are the problems with this approach? Well, once you add vertices to compute response functions, you can get the charge susceptibility and the spin susceptibility. From charge and spin, you can extract the potential energy. If you have the potential energy, you can integrate over a coupling constant to get the free energy, and the free energy that you have is not the same you started with. Okay, so it's not, no approximate theory is 100% consistent. That's one example of inconsistency. The other one is the Pauli principle in its simplest form, namely the square of the number operator on one side equals the number operator because it's one or zero. One square and zero square is the same number. So the Pauli principle in its simplest form is not satisfied by this type of approaches. Indeed, to satisfy Pauli principle, you need to take all possible cross diagrams. And unless you do perturbation theory to first order or second order, you're never able to include all the cross diagrams. And the Pauli principle is important. It's used in defining the Hubbard model in the first place. I mean, the reason you have only interaction with up and down is because you use the Pauli principle. Now, there's an infinite number of conserving approximations. In other words, any set of diagram, this formalism is such that any set of diagram I take will be thermodynamically consistent, satisfy conservation law, satisfy the Luttinger's theorem. So it doesn't tell me how to pick out the right theory out of an infinite number. I have to rely on some physical intuition for the choice of diagram. Finally, a last problem is that if you look at a self-energy diagram like this, then all these green functions are very strongly frequency dependent, and there's no vertex correction. I mean, the vertex correction is constant. So there's, in the diagrams that one typically takes for this type of approach, there's a sort of inconsistency from that point of view between the vertex corrections and the self-energy that enters the calculation.
I thought,
I mean, it
is designed to be self-consistent.
It's inconsistent in the sense that if you have a strongly frequency dependent self energy, like you do when you get the result, then there's one vertex here that should be strongly frequency dependent. And in practice, when you do the calculation, you always take it as a constant.
But that satisfies
word identity. Yeah, it satisfies word identities. There's no problem with that. But that's different. Word identities means I compute response functions from this. Now I'm saying, just look at the self-energy by itself. Self-energy diagram. If you follow this formalism, it is consistent in the sense that, you know, you'd start from a set of diagram, you take functional derivative. But if you look at the final result, I will just repeat the same thing.
So this diagram hides not only for charge density fluctuation, but also the superconducting fluctuation.
Yeah, yeah. You have an infinite set of diagrams. So you have superconducting fluctuations. Yeah. Whatever you do, the point is that in practice, you always take this vertex as constant. And you know from general skeleton diagrams that one of the vertices should be the rest. And if you look at the exact theory, the vertex that is there is the functional derivative of that self-energy. So if that self-energy is frequency dependent, the vertex has to be. Okay, so if there's a problem with this standard approach to perturbation theory, we're in big trouble, right? Because there is a standard model for every fermion, at least that's what Coleman told us a few days ago, and that's what inspired the title, actually. So the standard model for every fermion is precisely this. You have you exchange spin fluctuations. So it means we don't know how to properly solve that model. Then the Lee Rice-Anderson approach to, you know, these problems of pseudo gaps seems to work better qualitatively than this, which is a little bit, of this more sophisticated approach is a little bit disturbing at first sight. And then there are something that's called the GW approach to improve band structure calculations, which is also not self-consistent. That's what people use in band structure. Why do they use that instead of the self-consistent scheme, and which one should we believe is the best? So I'm trying to make the point it's important to know what's the best way of proceeding. So now let me mention the result of the approach that we have and tell you that it's valid for both u larger than zero and u less than zero. I'm going to present first results for u larger than zero and show you a set of transparencies which are just the proofs that it works. Okay, so my proof, my experiment is quantum Monte Carlo. So this is the charge structure factor, and this is a spin structure factor. So the spin charge as a function of wave vector on this axis. The top panels are for u equals 8. The bottom panel are for u equals 4. And the various symbols are for different fillings. So the quantum Monte Carlo are the symbols, and the results of our theory is this, are all the lines, all the solid lines are the results of our approach. So I claim that this is as close as you can get to a calculation of Fermi liquid parameters. In fact, Fermi liquid parameters is just this Q equals zero value, but we compute not only the Q equals zero value, but the whole value. And you understand we are far from the perturbative regime.
What are you
plotting? I'm plotting the charge structure factor and the spin structure factor along a cut, various cuts in the irreducible zone.
This all at temperature is point to?
The temperature is relatively high here, and we are away from affining. So I'm in a regime where we know the ground state is actually a Fermi liquid. And you can check analytically with our method that the self-energy gets all the Fermi liquid, you know, frequency and temperature dependencies in appropriate dimensions. Now, what about frequency-dependent quantities? So this is the spin structure factor at pi at zero frequency as a function of temperature. So the temperature, again, is relatively high, like you say. But if we look at quantum Monte Carlo calculation of White and Scalapino and Bulut, these points, then the results of our approach is this, and these more sophisticated approach give this. So you see, it's a sort of extrapolating in the wrong direction. Now let me show again this plot that I showed at the beginning. It's the same plot, except this time I have the result of our approach in the middle. So it's not perfect, but at least it has the pseudo gap. The peaks are a little bit too big, but many of the details are here. You see, if you look at this, this little bump is there, and well, the shape of the curves is pretty similar.
Is there any reason why you just did this at half filling? I'd be interested in away from half filling.
Oh, I can show you results away from half filling. Now let's look at the temperature dependence. Actually, the answer is clear for repulsive model is that away from half filling we have same problem, but for attractive model we can do it away from half filling. So let's look at the size dependence of these things. So this is 4, 6, 8, 10 by 10 system. And so the quantum Monte Carlo analytically continued is this. So as you see, the tendency for the pseudo gap seems to be closing. And if you look at our analytical approach, it also closes. In fact, it's clear that the size dependence is the same in both cases. But here we cannot go to infinite size system. Here we can, and we can show there is a limit. If you don't like maximum entropy, you can look at the raw data here. And this is this more sophisticated. This is the more sort of function of tau, right? This is the more sophisticated approach, and as you can see, I mean, the size dependence is wrong. I mean, you go from blue to, you see here you go from red to blue, here you go from, the point is just that if you look at these larger sizes, it has saturated here completely.
So flax gives a metal.
No, it's not a metal because it has very. I had some mathematics in an earlier slide. It shows that it's not Fermi liquid, but it's not a not pseudo gap. It has a square root type.
In the zero temperature domain, there's a charge gap.
No, there's no gap in the zero temperature limit. But the point is that it doesn't go to a delta function. So it's not Fermi liquid in that regime.
If you show your last graph, it'll give people who aren't familiar an idea just how tricky the maximum entropy is. You have a set of g of tau's at the bottom.
That's right.
And you look above them to see what they're doing.
Right. It's just the difference in this flat top, actually.
Yeah. I'm not challenging your maximum entropy, right, which I know about, but sometimes people wonder why we have trouble.
Right. But you can write an A of k and omega, find the g of tau exactly, and then work your way back with some maximum entropy and check how accurate you are. So
another question I had about eyeball these pictures, then I see in the sort of ultra many body itself that there ought to be a length scale of order of 6 and correlation length or something. Is that right? And
the correlation length. Yeah. The correlation length is getting close to the size of the system.
So it's magnetic correlation.
That's magnetic correlation. Yeah. And we can show analytically that precisely how the correlation length gets in this function, and it's not as sensitive as the spin fluctuation function.
So when you're at length scales less than the magnetic correlation length, the system sinks as an insulator, and when you get getting larger,
I'm going to get to this physics. Yes, the point is that as long as the anti-ferromagnetic correlation length is larger than the single particle thermal de Broglie wavelength, then the systems look as if it's ordered. On the other end, it's a subtle argument because it's dimension dependent. You need to look at the phase space. The same argument does not work in three dimensions, it works only in two. So dimension is important. So I'll just show you that it works for the attractive Hubbard model here. So again, the quantum Monte Carlo of Morio Scalapino is the dotted line, and our results is the solid line. So that's now the attractive Hubbard model, and it's not at half filling, right? It's a quarter filling. And not a quarter, I'm sorry, 0.87. And this is 1/2, 1/4, 1/6, and 1/8. Always in units where little t is 1, I forgot to mention.
Yeah,
And this is the n of k. So the it would be the Fermi function, if you want, if it was non-interacting. So this is from 0, 0 to 0 pi, and from 0, 0 to pi pi. So two directions in the Brillouin zone. And the quantum Monte Carlo, 3VD and Randeria is these circles. And the R theory is the solid line. And if you do a self-consistent T matrix, you get this dashed line, which is in fact worse than second order perturbation theory. In fact, in the wrong direction, but. And the dotted line is to show actually that if you don't include the vertex corrections I was talking about, you don't get good results. Okay, so there's another thing away from my filling. I don't have time. Now you'll be very happy to see all this mathematics flash in front of you. Because I will do it on the board. There's no way in trying to run through this. So for those, if anybody listens to this, we're on page 29. And I'll just talk a little bit about results. And I'll get back to the mathematics later. So what is the mechanism for pseudo gap? I will look at the attractive case, and it's completely analogous to the U greater than zero case that we had described in 96, and it's the same theory that basically Pines and Schmalian have been pushing. So I'm going to re-explain the same physics you told us already about. So you. As you decrease the temperature, the imaginary part of the pair propagator is becoming peaked at low frequency. In other words, if you look at this characteristic frequency here, it's becoming smaller and smaller as temperature decreases. So it's not like critical slowing down, nothing fancy really. If you look at this divided by omega, it's like a Lorentzian. You see that it's not, there's no particle hole symmetry, so it's not exactly at omega equals zero, but it's very close to omega equals zero. If you plot the position of this frequency as a function of temperature, eventually it becomes less than temperature, and that's what we call a renormalized classical regime. So it's classical again because precisely what you do in elementary statistical mechanics, if the typical frequency is less than temperature, then you're in the classical regime. So, and then what happens is that the pairing correlation length becomes larger than the single particle thermal de Broglie wavelength. In fact, we can show that this is about the criterion for this specific model. And you go from a single peak here to a double peak. And you can check the relative importance of the two lengths by looking at different directions in the Brillouin zone. And this is just quantum Monte Carlo to show that it's really happened. If you look at chi double prime for the pairing susceptibility divided by omega, you do have a single peak. So at high temperature, you have one third, it's a rather flat object. Then at a quarter, it becomes more peaked. At one fifth, then the characteristic width here is of order temperature. And it becomes size dependent, which indicates you start to reach the boundary of the system. So at high temperature, now this is the single particle spectral weight plotted as a density plot. So there's frequency, wave vector, and the darker means larger spectral, single particle spectral weight. So at high temperature, there's a peak at the Fermi level at omega equals zero. And as you decrease the temperature, I'm sorry, eventually a pseudo gap opens. And it opens actually where the Fermi velocity is smallest, which is what we expect. This is done relatively close to affilling, 0.95. At exactly at filling, the Costello-Stallus transition is at zero temperature. At 0.95 is very low. So here we have a large temperature range where this pseudo gap appears.
So this is just like, I should see this as a superconducting gap.
It's a superconducting pseudo gap, yeah. Now some. Now let me tell you how the spectral weight rearranges. So this is just some qualitative results now, a little bit of quantitative too. First, the pseudo gap appears in the total density of states before it happens in the single particle spectral weight. So for example, this red arrow is for a temperature of 0.211 or whatever, 0.2 something. So you see there's no pseudo gap in the single particle spectral weight. If we look at the Fermi wave vector, if we look at the total density of states, which is the sum of this over all wave vectors, there is a pseudo gap. And the physics for this I explained at this discussion session is that when you have this low frequency mode that is starting to scatter on the Fermi surface, it pushes weight out of omega equals zero. So in the total density of states, you see that the gap has appeared. And here, the way the weight has been pushed out is just like this. It has not made a dip yet. So that's all there is. The other thing is that clearly the pseudo gap, if you look at the total density of state, it fills in instead of closing. Right? If you look at the way, it goes up, up, and then it's sort of filled. It has not done this. Then the other qualitative result, this is for intermediate coupling, remember, it's U minus 4, so it's half the bandwidth. If you go from this temperature, which is 0.2, to the next temperature, which is 0.18, you have changed the temperature by 0.03 in these units. The absolute temperature is 0.2. And look at the scale over which you have rearranged the spectral weight. Here you had a peak, and now you have two peaks. And the separation between these two peaks is one, basically. So, you know, the spectral weight rearranges over scales much larger than both the temperature and the temperature change. And that's characteristic of strongly interacting systems. And it's easy to understand because this is for a given wave vector. So you come in with wave vector, and wave vector is a very bad quantum number now. So basically, you project on all eigenstates. So that's why you get rearrangements over huge frequency scales. So basically, in the end, in this attractive model, you get the crossover diagram, which is like this. The mean field transition temperature is nothing here. I mean, it tells you something will be coming, but really, the value of U is renormalized by the other channels, this like Kanamori-Bruckner screening. So instead, at the mean field transition temperature, not much happens. But then you get T star, which is a fraction of T mean field. And at this T star, you have a gap in this total density of states, pseudo gap. And then it appears later in the single particle spectral weight. And then you have the Kosterlitz-Taulis transition much below this. Okay, so this will be the arguing part. So I'll get back to some of the mathematics that I'll do on the blackboard. Now I'm supposed to turn this off without killing everything.
At U equal to minus 4, what kind of gap you find in the some idea of the zero temperature correlation length?
At zero temperature, it's infinite, the correlation.
I mean the intrinsic C.
Like C0.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have the data. We could look at it, but I don't know. I don't know. We'll look at the data together. Okay.
Probably of order of lattice constant. Your splitting was about 1. T is about 1, so it's probably T over delta.
Right. Right. Right.
Very short.
Right. Relative, still short. So, you can sleep for about 15 minutes if you're not interested in this detail that give you time to get ready for this conclusion, right? and so I will do some of the mathematics here. So, to show you what this, I showed you that it, I hope I convinced you that this scheme that we have works, and now I just tell you what the scheme is, basically. So I start from more general perspective, and I just write just remind you of many body theory from zero, okay? So I start from partition function with a generating sort of an external field, and this external field then this is a generating function, basically. So I have a time-ordered product of exponential psi dagger phi psi. Now I have to explain the notation here. I will write I will write 2, 1, 2, 1. And by 1 and 2, what I mean is R1 and tau 1, R2 and tau 2. And sigma I will leave explicitly. And I will put bars to remind ourselves that there's a sum over all discrete lattice points and an integral over all imaginary time. Now the Green's function G12, it will be a function of this phi here, but I will drop this, but we have to keep this in mind. It's minus delta log z phi 21, and this is minus psi 1 sigma psi dagger 2. With time order products as usual. And now I write the equations of motion for this. Actually, this is the more painful part of the whole process, but if you do it, you get not unexpectedly Dyson's equation. And the reason I do this is to see that sigma times g comes what? It comes from where? It just comes from the commutator of a field psi with the interacting part of the Hamiltonian. So you're not surprised to learn that sigma of 1, 1 bar, g sigma of 1 bar 2 is equal to minus u psi 1 dagger psi 1 psi dagger 2. So when you have three points that are at the same point, they come just from the interaction. And the psi dagger is the thing you stick in. And if you take the Lejeune transform of this, then you can show that sigma is the functional derivative of some other potential with respect to g. Now, response functions. So what I want for response function, I start from this. So a response function is just the functional derivative of this with respect to phi, because you see if I differentiate this with respect to phi, I just bring down another psi dagger psi, which is what I want for a response. So let me take then delta g delta phi, g minus 1, plus g delta g minus 1 delta phi is equal to 0. So the response delta g delta phi is minus g delta g minus 1 delta phi g. And now this I can calculate from this. So I get g, and this is just to remind myself that this phi here, when I functionally differentiate, was in the middle. And then I get plus g delta sigma delta phi g. But we know that sigma can also be written as a functional of g. So this is just g plus g delta sigma delta g delta phi times g. And then you recognize that it's just like in the particle hole channel, it would be like a RPA type equation. So there's one Green's function, another one coming back. Here this is the irreducible vertex in the particle hole channel. And this is my response function again. So you get the RPA like equation, or in the particle-particle channel, it would be just a Bethe-Salpeter equation. Now, it turns out that if you look at the spin fluctuations computed from this, the irreducible vertex corresponding to spin will be delta sigma up, delta g down, minus delta sigma up, delta g up. And the charge vertex will be the same with plus. Okay, let's see now how you would do Hartree-Fock with this formalism, and then I'll show you what we do. It will be very simple. So Hartree-Fock is what? Hartree-Fock is just take this and factor is two Green's function. So I will write an H for Hartree-Fock, 1, 1 bar, G, H, 1 bar 2 is equal to U, G minus sigma, 1 plus 1, g sigma 1, 2. And this is Hartree-Fock. Now I multiply by g minus 1 on both sides, and you get the well-known result for Hartree-Fock, that this is u times g Hartree-Fock 1 plus 1 delta 1 minus 2. And if I then take a functional derivative with respect to g, then the only non-vanishing one is delta g sigma up, delta g down, and that is u with all the delta functions you want. And the vertex for spin and charge are identical, which is RPA, the way you know from my school. Not quite. Now what do we do?
One plus just means
infinitesimal. One plus just means the time to figure out, you know, how to order these operators. So now what do we do? Okay, the idea is to do the same factorization as R3-Fock, but to correct for the case when this point 2 is at point 1. Why do we do this? Well, we do this because when this 2 is equal to 1, this is an up and down, and down and up, so it's double occupancy. So it's and it sort of serves as an initial condition for when the fermion separates, when this 2 separates. So in general, you know, we want to get the starting point correctly. So we get 1, 1. Then I don't know what it is, I will correct. I mean, this is a number A that I need to specify. And the relation, this expression when 2 is equal to 1 plus is the following. So sigma 1, 1 bar, g 1 bar 2, 1. So now I take 2 equals 1 plus. This is u times n up and down. So now I just determine A in such a way that when 2 is equal to 1 plus, this is satisfied. And what you find then is just that A is equal to u times n up and down divided by n up times n down. Actually, this is in the same spirit as what Singui did for the electron gas a number of years ago.
You called this Lee, Rice, and Anderson earlier too. Is that?
I'm not there yet. It
okay.
Will.
I don't see the connection.
That's right. Now I compute this vertices using this rule here. Now, in general, these functional derivatives act on, okay, now I can find sigma if I substitute the value of A here. Then sigma, I can just multiply by G minus 1 on both sides. And sigma is just, sigma 1, 2 is just equal to U and up and down divided by n up times n down times delta 1, 2. So when times g, I forgot, g, I erased one too many g's. So when this functional derivatives act here, they act on this, and in general they create a mess. But for the spin part, when we do this subtraction, then it the mess drops out because this is symmetric in spin. So we are left with u spin equals to u n up and down divided by n up and down. Okay, but now what is n up and down? Right, I don't know what n up and down is. Well, I add the fluctuation dissipation theorem, I can always determine, find a self-consistency equation. Why? Okay, because if I look at n up minus n down square, which is just this can be obtained from the spin susceptibility. You see, that's the local moment, basically. So n up minus n down square is equal to n up square plus n down square minus 2 and up and down, and the Pauli principle is satisfied. So and now this is T over N sum over Q. I have this irreducible vertex and I have the self energy which is here, so I can compute this object. And now U spin involves an up and down, and I have an up and down there, so I can close the system of equations.
I'm sorry, is this perturbation theory?
No. Where do you see perturbation theory? I mean, I cannot write any set of diagrams here for you.
What is the approximation?
The approximation is certainly that this can factorize everywhere but when 2 is equal to 1 plus. Okay, now if you look at this in very small u, you recover perturbation theory, yes. Now, if you, now to the Pauli principle, well, if I look at the charge fluctuations, then I have another vertex, which is U charge, and U charge is so it's chosen such that the Pauli principle is satisfied. Okay. Now, what about the self-energy? Self-energy at this level is rather trivial. It's just a constant. So let me go back to this this formula and notice that you can write this formula like this. So now I'm going to step 2 of the approximation. I'm sort of improving on our result. So this is minus u, and this function, what is this function? This is the function derivative of g12 with respect to minus sigma 1 plus 1 minus g minus sigma 1 plus 1 g sigma 1 2. Okay. So if I take this function derivative of g with respect to phi, I get this function, and I also get a disconnected piece which I need to subtract out, which is this piece. Now if I multiply this by g minus 1, so I get delta 1 minus 2, I get g minus 1 here, and I get sigma 1 2 here. And this piece is just the Hartree-Fock piece. So I get u n minus sigma plus something. Actually, it's a minus. But now, the minus something I get, I will write in shorthand. I write dg d phi. So it's the functional derivative of g up with respect to phi down. And so here g up does not depend on phi down. So the only term I have is this. And I have multiplied by g minus 1, so I get rid of this. So the only thing I'm left with is g delta sigma delta g delta phi. Now, if you look at the limit of infinite frequency for this self-energy, it is the Hartree-Fock piece. So it means that all of this is lower frequency. And we know that we did very well with the collective modes. Actually, all that I showed you for the collective modes came from this first. So what we do is we take everything here as g1. So here we have the response function, so spin and charge, the irreducible vertices, they are on the same level, and we have the Green's function. And we have one of the, and there's the u in front. So one of the vertices is bare, we know that, and the other one is renormalized. And that's it. So the double peak structure, everything I showed you, can come from this formula. For the attractive Hubbard model, is the same trick, except that you have to use matrices.
And that G is, I'm sorry, dressed?
No, it's not. Actually, it is dressed in a trivial way, in the sense that it is the Green's function at the same filling you will work with at the end. But it has constant self-energy, so everything moves in chemical potential. But indeed, so in that sense, it's like Lee Rice-Anderson. I mean, this G is like non-interacting Green's function. And this is like exchanging spin fluctuations. But they certainly did not have this vertex. And here, it's not phenomenological. I mean, if you can consider this as phenomenology when I do this hypothesis, but everything is determined within the model. There's no adjustable parameter. And for the attractive Hubbard model, it's the same thing, except you have to work with matrices and it becomes more complicated. You have more factoring. But
I think it's best to use that construction as a whole is conserving.
If you now take the Green's function you use, do you reproduce the correlation functions that you use to fix your...
I don't know how to compute this. Given this sigma 2 at the second level of approximation, I stop there. I don't know how to improve the response functions. So it's all conserving at the first level. You saw from the derivation, I mean, it's done in like conserving approximation. So all the response functions are consistent with the self-energy at the first level. Now I improve the self-energy at the second level. In other words, I'm saying that the collective modes influence fermions more than the other way around. So I compute a new self-energy, but to be able to compute response functions from this, I would need to take functional derivatives of that. And then it becomes a mess, and I don't know.
Most likely you don't reproduce your first level.
Most likely there will be a difference, and in fact, more generally, I can show you that. But that's there are consistency checks. What happened to? Oh yeah, I pressed this little button black.
Your logic is that you believe you got a good account of the collective
modes
with the first order.
Right.
Somehow the low frequency behavior of the collective modes will alter the self-energy, but in a way which...
Right, even if the fermions are wide a little bit, it shouldn't mess up too much the collective modes. But in other words, fermions have a first Matsubara frequency, which is finite, and the bosons have a zero Matsubara frequency, so...
You get very different answers if you just calculate some kind of Couperon propagator and just do a single self-energy, just an exchange the Couperon propagator.
Qualitatively, you will get the same thing, except that the Couperon may not satisfy the Merman-Wagner theorem, and you will not get the quantitative.
You're not satisfying lots of things now. How different is the result?
I mean, what calculation do you want to do?
Compared to if you have a fancy method, is it very different?
Well, it depends what you mean. It's very different in the sense that you have to make sure that the propagator is in the renormalized classical regime. If it is in the renormalized classical regime, you will get these two peaks that split. You will. So in that sense, it's not qualitatively different. So for the attractive model that I just showed the answers that you get. So again, there's a first level of approximation where you have the pair interaction is like that. It is determined from a sum rule, and the self-energy at the second step is this. You can show that this sum rule is satisfied for all wave vectors. It's a manifestation of the Pauli principle. You can show that this other sum rule here, which I have not seen in the literature, but which you can derive, it's like a generalization of the F sum rule, but in the particle-particle channel. You can show that this is satisfied for all wave vectors. And to get back to your question, there's sort of an internal consistency check in the theory, in the sense that trace of sigma at the second level times G at the first level is equal to U and up and down. But we know that what we should really have is trace of sigma 2G2 equals this. So in fact, we can see how accurate the theory is by how much this deviates from that. And in what I showed you, all the results I showed you is never more than than 10%. But when it becomes bigger than that, then it's bad. And the theory fails deep in the pseudo-gap regime. I'm not pretending that we can go deep in the pseudo-gap regime. I know, I mean far in temperature.
What low. About you though? Is that also cut off too?
Yes, I can go bigger than U equals to the bandwidth roughly. Okay, so now we can see what some of these results have to say or not to say about the high TC. So the first question is this: can this pseudo gap come from renormalized classical fluctuations? And I think the answer is probably no, in the sense that if you look at this neutron data, for example, this compound has a TC of 15 degrees Kelvin. We are looking at a temperature of 100 Kelvin, but it is heavily under dope, which means that probably we are in the pseudo gap. I mean, we are in the pseudo gap regime here. If you look at the position of this peak, then the characteristic frequency is around 20 MeV, so it's like 200 Kelvin. So the characteristic frequency is still larger than the temperature. It's sort of just on the border, but it sort of doesn't quite make it through. It's tempting, but it's sort of marginal. Then, what about quantum critical point? Well, what happens in this approach is that when you decrease the temperature, you become renormalized classical at some temperature. The correlation length is growing, and because the Merman-Wagner is satisfied, it grows all the way to zero temperature. So it becomes infinite at zero temperature. I don't quite know exactly what ground state it is, but it's tempting to say it's some sort of spin density wave ground state because it's the spin susceptibility that is growing to infinity. Now what happens as a function of u is that the range over which this correlation length diverges becomes larger and larger as a function of doping. And for the largest u we can reach, we get 0.3. I would say it's a quantitative result. I mean, this point seems to be at 0.3. And it's a quantum critical point in the sense that here we have Fermi liquid, here the correlation length is infinite. Now, let me speculate on to what happens when you increase U. So for this speculation, I look at the results in infinite dimension. And in infinite dimensions, what you get is a real phase transition when you don't get this renormalized classical regime. So for small u, you decrease the temperature. And when you hit that point here, this is the results of these people. When you hit that point, you get an anti-ferromagnetic transition. Then you move, eventually it becomes incommensurate. You increase u, it becomes this. So it's exactly like we found. I mean, the critical point is moving this way. Quantum critical point is moving this way. So in two dimensions, all that happens basically is that you remove this phase transition, the thermal fluctuations kill it, and you replace it by this pseudo gap regime. Now what happens at large u in infinite dimension is if you keep increasing u, this line pushes back, okay, towards smaller doping, in fact all the way to zero for u equals infinity. And you also, not only does it pull back, but you see that it is straight here. It looks more like this pseudo gap sort of line that people draw, which is pretty straight from 0.19 or 0.2. You know, the precise value will depend on u, and here it's infinite dimensions and so on. But somehow I have in mind that, you know, there may be all sorts of fancy explanations, but one need to explain, you know, at small u, I think we know what happens. That at large u, we sort of need to explain why the physics would be so different. It seems to be different in the sense that it's not quite renormalized classical, but yet, you know, you have to explain where this line would go before starting on fancy explanation.
Where is your incommensurate q for the largest u?
The largest u, the incommensurate q is 0.75 pi.
So it's along the diagonal?
No, it's along the...
Oh.
It's along the zone
edge.
Uh-huh. And finally, this is the last transparency. Thank you for being so patient. We have for u less than zero, we add pseudo gap also. Well, I think this may be relevant to only one region, and it is in this overdope region. If you look at recent, very recent experiments in these overdope compounds, they find a pseudo gap in night shift and NMR relaxation that's strongly magnetic field dependent. If you look in the underdope size on a range about 15 degrees near TC, then there is evidence of renormalized classical regime in these experiments of Orenstein and company. So I would say that in the pseudo gap that that is seen here should not be confused with that pseudo gap. I think this one nearby here is really the renormalized classical fluctuations. And if we go near to the 3D sun transition, there will be also renormalized classical fluctuation. But I mean, that's the two-dimensional line is this one really. And finally, one of the things we find in Monte Carlo, as I said earlier, is that if you look at this phase diagram for the attractive Hubbard model, this is affining, this is empty, and the Kosolitz-Taulis line does this, so it goes to zero temperature at n equals one, but the pseudo gap line stays high. So a larger symmetry group is something that enhances the pseudo gap region. So, okay, thank you very much for your attention.
I think we'll go back to the pseudo gap for just a minute. Your feeling about the actual pseudo gap then and recuperates is what?
I'm just saying that this, I mean, again, that's speculation, okay? I don't like to speculate, but just to make it fun, let's speculate. I'm just saying that this line is left over from two dimensions, basically. Even if U is strong, in high dimension, there would be a phase transition. In two dimensions, the thermal fluctuations kill that phase transition, but it leaves a sign.
And I'm sorry, it's a phase transition to the antiferromagnet, to what sort of?
Yeah. In infinite dimensions, it's a transition to the antiferromagnet. In two dimensions, in weak to intermediate coupling, it is a transition to antiferromagnet or spin density wave state. So in our case, it looks like an antiferromagnetic line.
So your sense is that it's something to do with the antiferromagnetism, but somehow you aren't comfortable saying it's the sort of thing you talked about because you can't quite reach the...
Right. I mean, because it's in the strong coupling regime, and I've looked only all the way to the bandwidth, really. So I have not really... I'm not able to study, or we are not able to study this strong coupling regime. But I would argue by adiabatic continuity, if you want, that even if U is very strong, I mean, in two dimension, this line, I mean, in weak coupling, this line is definitely the leftover from a transition, you know, a real phase transition in high dimension that is killed by thermal fluctuations. So I would say that in strong coupling, it's probably the same thing, but I have no proof. It's just speculation. But it's very close to being renormalized classical, but it's not quite renormalized classical. So there's some non-trivial quantum effects that are coming in, and there may be some very interesting things. But I would be very surprised if this was a phase transition with some hidden order of some sort.
But if it's spin density, how do you get this D-type structure in the pseudo gap?
Oh, that's no problem. No, because the scattering is always very strong at the pi zero points. So that's precisely where the pseudo gap opens, is at these pi zero points, before it does at the pi over 2 pi over 2 point. In fact, any sort of perturbation theory you do tells you that these pi zero points are very unstable. I mean, this scattering there is awful.
I'm sort of in between confused. I mean, so you're saying that this pseudo-gap line is supposed to come from low-dimensional thermal fluctuations. Now, when you look at any neutron scattering data, one thing is very clear, that these spin fluctuations, whatever spin fluctuation you're looking at, 5-pi magnetic resonance,
dimensional
fluctuations always shoot up to higher energies. Right, there's a sort of notion that there's a gap out there, and that gap is growing when you go to larger dopings, which is really a quantum behavior and is completely unrelated to renormalized classical. Look at a picture.
Yeah, you have this picture.
At optimal doping, there's a peak sitting at 40 MeV, and at low doping, it comes down.
That's right.
Right?
Right, but that's pseudo. But the pseudo. That's right. I said that it's quantum here, but it's, you know, it's. It's omega equals twice the is omega is twice the, and here, but that's okay because the pseudo gap is largest where this is at lowest frequency. Oh, it's, I don't see the contradiction really.
I just want to clarify some background material. In the beginning you said that flex does not give you a typical structure in the RPS, but then you also argued that if you do a simple Couperon exchange, you can get it. So flex exactly calculates this Couperon exchange problem.
But it does not have a vertex that is at the same level of approximation as the self-energy, is the argument.
If just an exchange of a Couperon already gives you a typical structure, so I don't think the vertex correction.
I can show you.
Somehow what's happened is, for example, the G0 has been used here, and that's what really brings it in. If you go further, which Flex will do, you try and address the self-energy in that G, you lose the dip that's being shown
right
here. And I think the Archimedes argument is, well, at the same time you do that, you better correct the vertex at the same level, and then perhaps, well, sorry.
That's right. No, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm not so sure it does, but certain approximations might bring it back. And this was always the trouble with Flex. Every time you improved the sigma that sat down at the bottom of that G, you further knocked out the pseudo.
And there's the mathematics for why there's no pseudo gap. You have this speed fluctuation, and you have this Green's function, which is dressed, okay? Now take this as a delta function if you want to make the spins as big as you like. And take it really renormalized classical, in other words, take only the zero Matsubara frequency contribution. Then you see you can do the integral over Q. This will replace this Q by zero around pi, let's say, pi. And this is on the Fermi surface, so this epsilon disappears, and this is just a number, it's delta square. So you have this formula, and you can solve this, and you find this imaginary a real part, and you see it as just this square root type thing. And whatever you do here, if you don't put any strong frequency dependence, you're bound to get this.
I think the thing that it seemed to me that you said in the very beginning of your talk, and then at least I lost once we got to the board, was this notion that if you could keep track of the very low frequency fluctuations, they, at least I thought you were saying, those were what were responsible for the pseudo gap.
They are in this intermediate coupling regime, definitely.
Yeah, that's what I also believe, but it seems to me that whether you obey the Pauli principle on site or you do various nice things there, perhaps has relatively little to do with whether you handle the low frequency part correctly. And that must have occurred when you wrote the line right behind you, and that G that got in there was a G zero or
right,
G1,
right,
that's the Lee-Rice,
that's right,
Anderson part.
Yes, but I'm saying that you know, I can show that it's not just fiddling or putting propagators or any. I mean, I'm showing you that if you compare with Monte Carlo, it is dead on. So it's more than just luck. And I'm saying that, you know, you need to include sort of some basic physical principles to get the things straight.
The G1 doesn't have any pseudo gap.
The G1 does not have any pseudo gap. That's right. Yeah, this is, for example, for the acrylic. I didn't show this, but this.
That's the message. The end of the message is, unless you'll fix the vertex.
Right. Yeah. Right. But and I think there may be ways to. There may be simple impurity problems where you can check this explicitly, but I have not done it, but.
Then somehow it makes you cautious. So in Flex, actually, if you try to do everything carefully, you find that the structure goes away. What you are doing, you're just stopping at the second step and saying, well, look, I get this thing. How do you know that if you try to do it like up to infinite order, it will not be worth
it? There's no order, it's not perturbative here.
Well, but you have G1, G2.
No, there's G1, and then I go the next step, and that's it. You don't know how to go any further. And, you know, show me any other method that gives this kind of agreement, and then, you know, I can.
Well, we just said it's like a simple.
No. I mean, look at, I mean, all the Fermi liquid parameters, are you able to calculate any Fermi liquid parameters in perturbation theory? I mean, if you talk to anybody in Fermi liquid theory, they will tell you you cannot compute Fermi liquid parameters. I show you can actually. This U spin and U charge are the Fermi liquid parameters, and I show you they are dead on the Monte Carlo. So it's no chance. I mean, it's not fiddling. It's.
Can you find a superconducting transition in 2D for the negative U?
No, but we should actually. We don't. But clearly, there's no Kostolits-Taurus physics there.
You can go as far as you want in doping, no problem. You find nothing.
No questions. No, but that's clear. I mean, yeah. In any of these things, you miss the topological excitation. Actually, you can show this is the N infinity universality class as far as phase transitions are concerned. So you don't get the N equal 2 vortices.
I think still the very first part of your talk, what you're telling us is that you better be prepared at some point to average over almost the static fluctuations.
But you see, this U spin is different from the bare U because of Kanamori-Bruckner screening, and that's all quantum effects.
That's high frequency stuff.
That's right.
Some of your numbers. That's
right.
But I think to get the kind of agreement you're finding with Monte Carlo is somehow you're handling the.
We have this
static part of the Matsubara field better.
Yes, but
Rice and Anderson better.
But because
that's only approximate, very approximate, I would think.
But because we have these sum rules. I mean, actually, we constrain the low and the high frequencies all together, right? So, and yes, you can just do. Here's an example of the difference in agreement. We see this plot here, for example. If you put instead of having U times the renormalized U in the self-energy, in other words, you don't have the vertex corrections. What you get is this dotted line here below. So you get as bad as second-order perturbation theory. So to get the quantitative things, you need every single factor I explained. And as I said, well, I showed you everything. I mean, it's an approximation. It's non-perturbative, so in some sense, it's like a mean field theory, you know, trying to improve it by trying to look at for other diagrams or anything like that doesn't make any sense. There are no diagrams here.
Okay, thank you very much.